Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Available seasonally at select Whole Foods markets. Learn more at hearstranch.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. And today I have a really, really fantastic guest. His name is Austin Frerich. Austin is an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy, so you're going to really want to pay attention here. During the 2020 presidential campaign, he advised candidates Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Pete Buttigieg on agricultural policy before ultimately serving as co-chair of the Biden campaign's Agriculture Antitrust Policy Committee. He is a fellow of the Thurman Arnold Project at Yale University, an initiative that brings together faculty, students, and scholars to collaborate on research related to competition policy and antitrust enforcement. He also serves on the board of directors for Common Good Iowa and the Socially Responsible Agriculture Project. In 2022, The Advocate named him a champion of pride. His book and what brings him to this program is called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. Island Press is the publisher. The pub date is March 26th, so right around the corner. You can order it now and do it, because this is a real eye-opener of a book. You know, Austin, thank you so much for being on the show. I've been doing this program now for 14, I guess I'm now in my 15th year, right? As long as this radio station, this podcasting station has existed. And one of the lessons that I learned very early on as I began diving into the agricultural system is that the primary culprit in all of the woes that we face in terms of how agriculture is affecting communities and the environment, the markets, et cetera, can be entirely laid at the feet of monopolies and vertical integration, especially of the animal agriculture industry, but really of all of the agricultural industries, including seeds, agrochem, machinery. You know, you name it, whatever goes into farming is pretty much, and comes out of farming is pretty much controlled by just a handful of corporations. Do I have that about right?
You have it totally correct. And also, sorry, thanks again for having me on. No, this sure. Stuff is, I joke, there's a great President Kennedy line where both farmers are being squeezed on the input and output side.
Right.
I've just seen this, that just intensified like crazy in these last few decades.
Absolutely. So we're gonna dive right in now. So first of all, again, the book is called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. So first of all, you obviously were interested in antitrust, you know, years ago. But what got you going on why antitrust is really such a culprit in all of the problems that we face in this community?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be like probably the nerdiest answer possible. But this was the summer of 2015. I was... in a past life, I was a tax economist at the U.S. Department of Treasury.
Really? And
yeah. I mean,
you'll forgive me if I say that you look like a freaking choir boy. I mean, you're a publicity shot. You look, I mean, maybe 20, maybe. So you don't need to say how old you really are, but it's kind of, your CV is absolutely astonishing. Again, I'm rendered completely helpless with insecurity at the sight of such an accomplished person.
I appreciate it. I joked to my mom the other day, it's because I discovered Olay a few years ago, but she's doing a lot of shit for that. I was, you know, it was 2015. It was the end of the Obama administration, so we had a lot of downtime. And from like a research perspective at Treasury, we have all the taxpayer records on our computers. So from like, you can do population level research. And I was writing a paper about how the growth of monopoly level profits in the U.S. corporation tax code, which is, you kind of expect in pharmaceutical, that's the deal you make, you get an IP monopoly. But I was seeing it in food, and that blew my mind. And I didn't quite understand what was going on. So I started Googling around, and then I met this young woman. I found this paper, first this article about chicken monopolies, and then this paper about Amazon's monopoly. And this young woman's name was Lena Khan. We got coffee at some little place in DC, and she told me about this antitrust stuff, like this big battle going on in America, the corporate capture of this framework, how it explains a lot of the rise of monopolies in America. And for me personally, I'm the first in my family to go to college. I'm from Iowa, like everything kind of fell apart in Iowa.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was also, to be frank with you, supporting Bernie Sanders in 2015.
Sure.
And I was working at a place where, I mean, I had never seen real money before in my life. And most of my coworkers were prep school kids. And I was just like, you guys don't get it. You don't get what's going on in the bigger picture here.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, this monopoly stuff, what I personally loved about it too, is it's bipartisan because it taps into the anger that fueled President Trump, but it redirects it. Where instead of blaming the immigrant, to me, blame the meatpacker.
Yeah, right. Blame the corporations. I mean, I'm all in on blaming the corporations. I mean, like I said, I'm an aging hippie, you know? we know what they've done.
Yeah, and like that's what makes this Barron framework so fun. To me, it's almost campy. It's just like, first of all, you know, I'm harkening back to something we've done before. So it kind of, I'm touching on something, a problem we know how to deal with. But also, they're just fun narrative vehicles to tell these bigger stories of, you know, corporate greed and corporate malfeasance.
Right. Well, and you do a fantastic job. So let's just tell people, you profiled seven major categories and players in our food system. And they are not just, you know, Cargill or Tyson. So tell us who they are and sort of how you decided those were the stories you needed to tell.
Yeah. So I kind of did this the reverse way, where I figured out what each baron to me is more about, like I'm telling you about a structure. So like Cargill's my grain baron, but that chapter is really about the farm bill. So when I first kind of designed this book, I joked to my husband, like, this book to me is almost like Profiles in Courage, but like the bad version.
You're right.
So I found what concepts I wanted first. And then I tried to find the right baron to tell these stories.
Got it.
So my book opens with a hog baron in Iowa. And that whole chapter is about the corporate capture of my home state. Like, how did Iowa become an extraction colony? How did one hog farmer become the most politically powerful person in the state?
Mm-hmm.
So then
very interesting.
I go to grain and farm bill. From there, then I go to coffee, and that's really about antitrust.
Mm-hmm.
Dairy, to talk about these really unknown but super powerful thing at USDA called the checkoffs.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Driscoll's is my berry baron, and I talk about how basically we've offshored our produce production supply chain and how they took this model of chicken farming and applied it to berries, which is wild to me.
I want to talk about that. We're going to talk about that more in a little bit, because that to me was so, you know, I had not made that connection, but it was 100% correct. Really interesting.
Oh, I mean, but so much of this too, I'm just put a pin in it, is you make these connections as you're right. I mean, that was not my original proposal for this book, was talking about, I just realized like, oh, they're doing the same thing I've seen in chicken.
Uh-huh.
And no one really touched or reported on this.
Yeah, right.
And it's because they have this very, the Driscoll brothers, they're very prominent kind of corporate Democrats. Like, they co-wrote op-eds in national papers with former Governor Jerry Brown. Like, they have a very good image. And so it was just such a disconnect with, you know, the image they portray. Mm-hmm. But then the last two barons in my book are, one's JBS, my slaughtering baron, how we're basically back in the air of the jungle.
Yep.
And my last baron, and the one, this is another one I didn't originally plan to write about, was Walmart. I mean, Walmart is my grocery baron. And I view Walmart as almost the king of the kings, like the head baron of the table.
Mm-hmm.
We've never seen a company this powerful in the food system before.
It's absolutely true. I mean, people do not realize, and we're going to talk about that, but the market share that they control, you know, through their stores, is really breathtaking. Let's start by talking about something that you brought up quite early in the book. And that was what you called the Wall Street Farm Bill, because a lot of what happened when they passed the Wall Street Farm Bill has, back in what, the Reagan era, I guess, that has had a knock-on effect that has arrived where we are, with monopolies, and also with the incredibly weird products and crops that we choose to subsidize at the expense of other more worthy projects. So let's go into that structure of subsidies.
Yeah, I mean, let me start off by saying, and it took me a while to realize this, that there's no free market in the food system. Everything you eat is subsidized. The question is to what degree? And part of me writing this chapter was I just felt like there was nothing out there that explained the farm bill in common speak. It's right. Super technical. And I kind of just have this, I think it's because of my background, this inherent notion that so much of this moment we live in is language is designed to keep people out.
Yes.
And the food system is full of that. I mean, the joke, the dairy program in America is like, the joke with the dairy program is that only 5 people understand it and 4 of them are dead.
I've not heard that. That's excellent. I'm sure dairy farmers would not be laughing, but I am.
I mean, the ones that are left. I mean, that's the dark undercurrent. But no, I mean, I just had this realization when you study these programs, you're like, because to me, it reminds me of the tax code of how they all kind of, you can't look at one thing in isolation, like just crop insurance. Mm. You got to see how it interacts with another program. And to me, to rewind the clock, going back to what I call the New Deal Farm Bill, that came out of the Dust Bowl. That became, right. Came out of markets were glutted. Farmers were engaging in very destructive environmental practices because they were just trying to squeeze the last dollar out of their land to save their land. So this framework comes along, this farm bill of just managing supply where we'll give you subsidies, but you have to take some land out of production. You have to put some land in conservation, do that kind of stuff. They were interlocking. Fast forward, and what you basically seen from the Reagan on, and I really focused on the 1996 farm bill because I think it's the crucial moment that all that supply management went out the window, and now the system is designed to overproduce grains at the expense of everything else. Right. So if you grow carrots, you don't really get anything in the farm bill. But if you want to grow corn, you're getting subsidies indirect and direct up the wazoo. And what that does is just, it's all about making really cheap animal feed and also really cheap, highly processed foods. And right. I talked then about
And biofuels. Don't forget biofuels. Right. Another incredible boondoggle.
Yeah, no, I didn't have a conversation over biofuels in my book. I just said, these things are a joke. They're a farce. They don't do anything for the climate. The conversation's over.
Right. Thank you. That's about it. I've talked quite extensively about biofuels on the show. So yeah, that's the conclusion we came to.
Yeah, I had to say that because like my dad works at an ethanol plant. I mean, like I grew up in that world. I understand it. But like there's a delusionalness in Iowa where people still, it's 2024, like, the amount of like, it's just, it's not, the climate's in crisis right now. We don't have time for your greed or like for your gaslighting. It's just like such a, the thing that I can't get my head around is in the Corn Belt is cars are moving to EVs, electric vehicles. That market's going to collapse, but there is no conversation over it. All they're talking about is putting ethanol in airplanes now.
Yeah, right. That's how they're going to bridge that gap. They're going to, you know, switch it from cars to airplanes, where it'll be even more inefficient and they'll need even more corn because ethanol is a notoriously inefficient fuel, as we know. So, I don't see anything good coming out of that. So basically the Wall Street Farm Bill, which, I mean, yes, you focused on 1996 and for people who haven't been paying attention, the Farm Bill expires every 5 years and the most recent one expired last year and they were supposed to have a new one up and going and voted on by, I think, September. Isn't that right? And then they have now had to postpone it more or less indefinitely because of the dysfunction of the American Congress. So
I actually find this weirdly to be a silver lining, though. What they're going to try to do is ram it through during the lame duck. That's what I hear. But I don't know if that will even happen. And what you're seeing to me on the Republican side is that coalition's breaking down. I mean, their own members are saying this is getting too glut. This is too much welfare, corporate welfare. I mean, crop insurance especially, is the cost of it is just getting insane. I mean, they're also trying to gut food assistance. That's a whole different conversation. But like the farm bill itself, the farm entitlement programs are just, usually Republicans give industry whatever they want. You're seeing actual pushback here.
That's unusual. Most definitely. So when, to go back a little bit into the Wayback Machine, as people who grew up in my era would remember from Rocky and Bullwinkle. In the Wayback Machine, we learned that Louis Brandeis made a considerable effort to dial back monopolies And some legislation was passed, some of which people are familiar with, like the Sherman Act. There was another big bill, which was more of a Teddy Roosevelt era act. But Brandeis also, in later years, managed to get some people to pay attention to what he was saying about monopolization and antitrust. Can you talk a little bit about what he tried to accomplish and where that started breaking down?
Yeah, well, let me first start by saying I didn't realize the Wayback Machine term came from Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Yeah, Peabody.
I just know that as a researcher where a lot of my barons will delete their websites, and so I have to go to the waybackmachine.com to find the website.
I'm so glad I was able to share that with you, Austin. You'll have to ask your parents.
I laugh because literally my dairy baron is deleting things left and right now. And
really?
Yeah, so you got me there.
That's hilarious. I'm going to have to look up the waybackmachine.com. I didn't even know about
it. It's great. It photographs every website, so that way there's always a record, even if you delete something.
Fantastic.
But to Brandeis. So Brandeis, fascinating man, comes out of Kentucky, comes out of a family business, was a lawyer in Boston, and he famously fought J.P. Morgan.
That sounds right.
Okay, railroad monopoly in New Haven. And what he saw is just all the corners cut, all the abuses, all the bribery, all that kind of stuff. And he really had this ingrained notion that concentrated economic power, especially through mergers, acquisitions, is just bad politically. It just corrupts the political system. It's bad for the business world, bad for competition, bad for democracy.
Yeah.
So his whole thing is about diffusing power, which, by the way, that is like what America is at its core. Like that's the way our government is structured, is diffusing power.
Right.
So he comes along during that Gilded Age, gets nominated to the Supreme Court in 2013, 1913.
Yeah. And
longest, appointment because it was contested by industry, but he gets on the court and really helps usher in this new antitrust framework in America of deconcentrating power, which honestly held for decades in America. I mean, it's part of why in response to the jungle, we saw what happened to these immigrant low-wage workers being abused by monopolies. And then in response, you have this framework take hold and you see this profession become a solid middle-class profession. Competitive markets, good payments for farmers. My grandpa worked at a slaughterhouse in Cedar Rapids. But then what we've seen is the systematic destruction of this framework. And I tell this story, it's really rooted in Robert Bork.
Yeah, I loved that you talked about Bork because, I mean, most people, again, for those of us who were not alive at that time, Robert Bork, the hearings for Robert Bork were probably the first time I really tuned in as a young person. I think I was a teenager in my early 20s. And that was the first time I really tuned in to a Supreme Court justice hearing. And I didn't like what I heard. And fortunately, he was not put on the court, but he nevertheless had an immense impact on our food system. I mean, not just our food system, but all industry, but it had a really significant impact on the food system. So tell us what his vision was and how it differed from that of Louis Brandeis.
Yeah, so I mean, his whole thing is basically big is okay. Companies converge so long as you can show that leads to lower prices for consumers.
And efficiencies in production, right? That was the big mantra then.
That's the soundbite. First of all, they use language that no one understands, like consumer welfare standard. Those words mean nothing, but they sound smart. But you can also find any economist to give you the numbers you want. I mean, I tell the story how one economist at the University of Chicago made over $100 million coming up with these junk numbers. You're just doing the intellectual bidding of the rich. And I should also say, this is to be expected. This is a tale as old as time. There's always going to be people like him that come along that just, sure. I mean, to me, I learned this writing this book is every industry has a Robert Bork type figure.
Sure.
But what happens with him is you just see the collapse of this, competition protection framework. And you just see massive consolidation to where I talk about how my coffee baron, they're a secret German family. They bought their first American coffee company in 2012. quickly bought all these companies that they probably could not have done decades ago before the Bork framework took hold. And now they sell more coffee than Starbucks.
And right. And Austin, just quickly, because that was a real eye-opener for me, like who the coffee barons are, because here are all these companies. Like I remember when Stumptown Coffee started and everybody in Brooklyn, you know, was like, oh, it's Stumptown, it's local, it's processed here, it's this, it's that, it's fair trade, blah, blah, blah. Come to find out in your book, they're owned by JAB.
And that's a recent thing.
Yeah. And they've got a whole bunch of other like earthy, crunchy brands that everybody thinks is squeaky clean. And they're part of this monopoly.
It's part of the difference between this Gilded Age and the last one was the last one, you know, just had Standard Oil. But now because of inequality, they want to sell it's different price points. So you got to have the coffee for the Whole Foods consumer, but then coffee for the Dollar General consumer, because that Whole Foods consumer wants to think they're buying different coffee beans.
Right.
So that's what JAB came in. They bought like Panera, Krispy Kreme, Pret a Manger, those little Keurig cups.
Yeah.
They just want to buy, because it's all about having as much buying power. So when you buy from the farmers, you can squeeze them more and more. I mean, that's really what it's about.
Right.
And so it's, That chapter was really hard to write, but I really love that chapter because their story is so fascinating, so dark, where, you know, this German family, I mean, they were a chemical company back in the day and they were early supporters of Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
I tell that whole story and I think it's been lost to history of after World War II, the Library of Congress did a big report on how did this happen. And one of their big findings was monopolist finance fascists.
Yeah.
And you can see what point I'm trying to make, what modern day point I'm making there. I'm not even going to be coy about it.
Yeah, but don't be coy. Because, I mean, to me, that was the most interesting aspect of your book was the parallel or the connection that you draw between monopolistic power and untrammeled industrial power and the rise of right-wing extremism.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
It is. And I mean, I think Iowa is such the perfect case study to do it. The state that the biggest flip from purple to red in the last few decades. And I mean, you saw the collapse of the family farm in my lifetime. And you saw the offshoring of the manufacturing supply chain. And these towns just fell apart. And it's not shocking that people are clinging to a strongman. And also, I just don't think urban America really, especially these elite blue cities, get the state of decay. I don't want to use the word decay because that's such a weird. I do a lot of talks in these communities and people don't want to hear how dark it is. I mean, that's the thing is they know it. They see that the businesses are closing, the kids are leaving.
Well, I was going to say they see all of the, I mean, in Iowa, especially, you know, weirdly, Austin, I do an enormous amount of programming around the state of Iowa because Iowa is, you know, to use yet another cliche, it's the canary in the coal mine because you've allowed the meat industry to take over. You've allowed your water to be polluted. You know, you've allowed the corn and soy monopolies to take, you know what I mean? Like your land is degraded. Your water is undrinkable. You have people being, you know, ousted from their university positions because they dared to, you know, speak up about the water pollution that these, you know, farming barons have brought to bear on the state of Iowa. And then you have a government that is bought and paid for by these corporations. So, I mean, to me, the amazing thing is that the people of Iowa haven't risen up en masse with pitchforks and torches to get rid of these.
That's a point. That was something I really learned in my Hog Baron chapter was, first of all, people tend to think, oh, these models just happen because they're the most efficient. And you just realize that is simply not true. There were a lot of corners cut. But people fought power and they lost. I mean, I talk a lot in my book about the 2002 governor's race in Iowa. Secretary Vilsack, the current Secretary for Agriculture under President Biden, was governor of Iowa at the time running for re-election.
Right.
He's running against the head lobbyist for my Hog Baron. And one of the big issues were the rise of these industrial hog facilities in Iowa.
Sure.
Bill ran all these ads attacking him, like saying how awful this was, promising to do something. And the way Iowa is structured is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of these confinements. Well, after Vilsack wins and gets everyone's hopes up, all these activists, like people were packing these small town gyms in Iowa. He oversaw the largest expansion of hog CAFOs in Iowa history.
Yes, he did.
And that is how you break democracy. Like, that is really, it's when you give people false hope and you lie and you stab them in the back. I mean, that is the story of his tenure. He oversaw the death of the hog family farmer as governor of Iowa, and then the death of the dairy family farmer as secretary of agriculture. And yeah. People like that are, I can't say that enough. I don't want to, people, it's like Stockholm syndrome is kind of what I've noticed in my conversations with people is they can't afford to move. I mean, in America, your house is your everything. It's your wealth. These homes are worth maybe $80,000, $120,000. You can't afford to move where your kids are. You can't afford to leave to Des Moines. So Des Moines is very expensive now. Mm-hmm. And so you have to make peace with power. You try to fight it. You didn't. And I don't know. I don't want to blame. People try to fight power. Like I want to give them that benefit of the doubt of public officials really, pardon my French, screwed them. And so you just see the hopelessness that I've set into these communities.
Well, it's interesting. I just came back from Cuba, and you want to talk about a failed state. But that's the same feeling I got from them, is they're just, there's nothing, they have nothing left to fight with. They're just so freaking defeated. It's just, they just shrug their shoulders and say, life is very hard, and you move on to the next topic. I mean, it was tragic. And that's sort of how I, you know, how I see what's happening in Iowa now. It's just like, what are we going to do? We can't, you know, it doesn't really matter. We have these legislatures that gerrymander and, you know, purge voting rolls and, you know, all of the tricks of the trade.
We can go down the dark wormhole that is Iowa, but like the two things to keep in mind, Katie, is one is it tends to be an external shock that rivets, you know, shakes things up. And to me, I really do think it's the collapse of ethanol that will be the come to Jesus moment here, because ethanol is going to meet its maker. I mean, it's just that market will collapse. It's just a matter of time. You're just watching Wile E. Coyote run off the cliff right now. But the other thing too is like the dirty secret of Iowa is the largest industry now is insurance. I mean, Des Moines is a financial town. It's the fastest growing city in the Midwest. At some point, rural, I mean, the industry is going to hollow out its voter base in rural America. And the, you know, yeah. I mean, that's what happened in Minnesota, where Democrats control the state because of Minneapolis.
Uh-huh.
So who knows? I don't know. I want to like, I just think to like step back for a second. I think the power of Iowa is to agriculture what Hollywood is to films in the American conversation over the farm bill, over the food system. And so you're right. It's a canary in the coal mine, but it can also be like a model where we go from here.
Yeah, I'd like to see that model start taking shape. We have to take a short break for a sponsor drop. We'll be right back with Austin Frerich to talk more about his book, Barrens, coming out very soon from Island Press. Stay tuned.
Hearst Ranch, in collaboration with Whole Foods Market, is proud to be the presenting sponsor of The Farm Report, a special HRN series in collaboration with the National Young Farmers Coalition. Tune in each week to hear from farmers, policymakers, organizers, and food advocates about all the ways the Farm Bill directly impacts our lives, whether we realize it or not. They'll break down farm policy and talk to young farmers about what hangs in the balance for them as another Farm Bill gets made. Join the coalition to shift power and change policy for the next generation of growers and land stewards. The future of good food depends on it. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All righty. So let's get into some like very specific things in each, or not each chapter, but some of these. We're of course quickly running out of time. But we mentioned in the first half of the show the parallels between the chicken at slash hog contract model, which my listeners are quite familiar with. I talk about that a lot. And the berry model developed by Driscoll's, which as we all know is the, you know, behemoth from which we buy all of our strawberries, raspberries, and blueberries out of season at least. So tell us about how that particular, you know, how they very neatly avoided having any responsibilities.
This is my favorite cocktail chatter for the book, where I tell people,
I bet
Driscoll sells 1 in 3 berries, but doesn't grow a single berry. Cause it's always such a like, what? Right. Cause it's such a bougie brand.
Yeah. And they are making money hand over fist. Oh my God. It's so expensive. And how much do they chart? How much do they pay their workers? you had like a nice little statistic on your strawberry workers.
They're not their workers. Keep that in mind.
That's true. Right, because they're contracted.
Yeah. They basically, well, before we get to that real quick, let's step back where, to me, the key thing with chicken, and I know your listeners know a lot about chicken, but something I learned right researching this book is when the regulations were written after the jungle for the meat industry, chicken wasn't included.
That's right. That is
so key because there wasn't a chicken industry. People, you just had a chicken in your backyard and you killed it. Mm-hmm. So chicken was able to copy that sharecropping model production and incredibly exploitive, as everyone knows. But the key thing here is USDA failed to make chicken behave like the other proteins as it gained market share. And instead what happened is the other proteins started behaving like chicken, most notably pork. Right. And so, I mean, the kind of the brilliance is a weird word to use here, but the brothers that took over the Driscoll empire, they had two really key smart business moves. One was, first of all, realizing the rise in Walmart, where you have a national company that wanted four berries year round. And so, and berries are very finical. They have certain production schedules. So they grow berries on every single continent in the world except Antarctica, because that way, you know,
you have a year-round supply, right?
Bingo. And then on top of it, they took that model of sharecropping and applied it to berries. And it's part of this whole neoliberal NAFTA thing where anything that's labor-intensive in the produce system is slowly shifting offshore, because that way you can basically hire children or exploit your labor and the environmental and ignore environmental standards for the lowest production cost possible. And so, like I talk about, you see a lot of berry production in California shift to Baja, where you basically have what I would argue are modern day plantations, where you have a lot of indigenous people working on these little, working on these plantations. Keep in mind, this is an area that is just as dry as Death Valley. Driscoll built a desalinization plant on the ocean after basically draining the aquifer to supply its contract growers.
Right.
Driscoll's realized it's kind of like Nike, where it wants to own the IP and the brand, but it doesn't want to actually engage in the exploitive production process. That way it can also be ignorant. But part of it, thing to keep in mind too, besides all of this awful labor and environmental exploitation, is it makes for a really bad product. You know, that berry is engineered for durability, not for taste.
True.
And so to me, that's like an undercurrent of all these barons too, is the collapse of taste in the American food system now. It's just, you're paying a lot for garbage.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think anybody who's traveled outside of this country knows that, you know, if you go to pretty much any other country where they don't have this system, whether it's a tomato or a raspberry, it's a completely different animal than what we see in our supermarkets year round.
Yeah.
And it's why we shop at farmers markets in the summer, so you can get local stuff.
Oh, and I, even writing this book, I love doing taste testings. Like,
sure.
When I was writing my Dairy Baron, I had people do like a milk tasting. Like I had them try, my Dairy Baron's milk's called Fairlife. I had them try that, normal industrial dairy, and then pasture milk. And even though it's all 2% milk, it's so different in taste because the inputs are so different.
Sure. Absolutely. You know, I want to quickly touch on NAFTA, because that connects with the whole sort of offshoring of fruit and vegetable production, which you mentioned earlier. And then also it also dovetails into the whole Driscoll story. Talk a little bit about what NAFTA did to workers, wages, and unions, because it was, despite it being signed into law with great fanfare by Bill Clinton in the 90s as like, oh my God, this is going to be revolutionary. It's really had, it has had a revolutionary impact, but not perhaps the one that we were anticipating.
Yeah. For me, I feel like this one is the underappreciated.
Yes, I would agree.
Damage in the food system where, I mean, I first saw it, I read this article 10 years ago in the Christian Science Monitor, where it's like 70% of apple juice in America is coming from China.
Even though we grow apples here.
Yeah, that blew my mind because like my grandpa had an orchard growing up. I love apples. You can grow, like, they're so easy to grow an apple. And what I realized is, why are you shipping water halfway across the world? Oh, it's because of labor. Like somehow labor is cheaper to ship an apple, factored in the transportation cost, than it is to grow it here.
Incredible.
So I started thinking about that. And, you know, researching it. And then what you realize is with these free, I don't even want to say the word free trade, these exploitive trade agreements, what they do is, first of all, it undermines all the labor gains by people like all these farm worker unions, like Cesar Chavez, because any improvement in their quality of life in California is undercut the second, you know, that berry goes across the border to Mexico. Also, keep in mind with these like modern day plantations in these developing countries, you only see a fraction of the abuses because of the state of journalism now. It's so hard to report this stuff out. And so you just know it's just way worse than what we're seeing.
Sure.
And then this whole free trade stuff too is, I mean, it's just bad for the climate. I mean, you just think of like when you're shipping strawberries halfway around the world, you're shipping organic or like apple juice halfway around the world. It just doesn't make sense. It's just, it's so cartoonishly dumb.
It is frighteningly stupid. But at the same time, you know, we have to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here. You know, as Patrick Martins famously said, Patrick is the one who started the Heritage Radio Network. As he famously said, if they grow better apricots in Yemen, then that's where we should be getting apricots. We shouldn't be, you know, trying to replicate that inadequately in our country just for the sake of saving, I guess, those shipping costs. I mean, I think to a certain extent, you have to balance that, right? Because you have to support these other countries because we're all in it together, right? At the same time, you have to recognize where you're wasting money and resources. So I don't know the answer to that equation.
You
know, but
you're totally right. I mean, that to me is, and here's the thing, USDA should be balancing it. And it's, I mean, the story of this, another undercurrent of this whole book is a failure of USDA at every point possible. Where, like, the example I think of all the time is if you go in Trader Joe's, you'll see like an organic juice and it's from Turkey.
Yeah.
And it's just like, that's just BS. I mean, Turkey is known in the organic space for having rampant organic label fraud.
Sure.
And it's just like, and like the way the whole label's structured, I mean, there's this whole issue of like, it, you just undermine people doing it right with the organic label here. And, you know, USDA is not doing its job. And it's just one of the, so it's, that to me is a bigger issue here is there is a balance here. And I think I really want people to take away from this book of how radical the system we have now is.
Mm-hmm.
It's so shifted to one side that it's just, it's destructive for everyone.
Right. And it's, and it has led, you know, and we didn't draw this point earlier, but when you were talking about sort of how our subsidies have, among other things, aside from hollowing out rural communities, supporting crops that we don't really need like corn, but it has led to deleterious health outcomes because the more corn syrup we eat, which is now in every, you know, product on the, your, in the center aisles of your grocery stores, every single molecule of that stuff adds to the obesity crisis, the heart disease, the diabetes, and all of the other diet-related illnesses that we face in this country that far exceed virtually any other country in the developed world. So, you know, there, yes, you're absolutely right. The USDA has utterly failed.
And that was a really delicate section to write because for so long, the conversation over the obesity crisis in America has been rooted in a personal responsibility thing where it's so clear now it's structural. I mean,
right.
I don't think it's been, we fully grappled with the fact that it's so correlated to class too,
mm-hmm.
where historically for centuries, it was the rich that were the overweight class. And now we've seen the inverse where you need to be healthy. You need to have money to be healthy in America. And
yeah,
my
that's right.
Is what Ozempic will do, where I think it'll just turbocharge that. Where like you're seeing the highest use of these diet drugs in like the Upper East Side, you know? Where it'll just be another marker in America of the have nots.
Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, we're gonna have to shut this down in a couple of minutes. Let me just look at the time here. Yeah, we have like 4 or 5 minutes left. What are your prescriptions? I wanted to talk, actually, before we go to prescriptions, let's spend a minute revisiting that topic that we brought up in the first half about, you make a point, and I'm going to read your quote, "That's why concentration of economic power has long been closely associated with a rise in extremist politics." And like I said, this to me was one of the most interesting concepts in the book. And I want you to kind of unpack that a little bit more for the audience, because this is a really important point. Consolidation equals autocracy, essentially,
yeah.
Right?
Yes. I mean, because it's like two things drive it. One is, you used to have all these independent family farms in Iowa, all these hog farms. Now a lot of these people are just low-wage workers working for a hog baron. And it's not even low wage. I don't think people realize how awful these jobs are. You're dealing with very unhappy animals stuffed inside these metal sheds.
Yeah.
It is such degrading work. And So you just have that, what used to be your own person, your own personal small business is gone now. On top of it, I view a lot of rural America at this point as extraction colonies, where they're producing the most they've ever produced, but all that money is leaving, is being captured by a few people. And then these people also have so much power and money where they're able to shape the news. I mean, I don't think that's been appreciated in the Midwest, especially as the corporate capture of that news ecosystem. Like in Iowa, the local news, TV news at night, the agriculture report is actually paid for by industry. So
of course.
It's almost like, imagine living in West Virginia in the 19th century and your business report at night came from the coal industry. That's where we are. And so.
Yeah, absolutely. The only honest reporter that I know of in Iowa is Art Cullen from Storm Lake Times.
Art Cullen in like the Sea Rapids Gazette is a really good paper too, because it's fully owned. That's key. So that to me is what really fuels this is, and then you just have these social media platforms are just libertarian hellscapes. And I mean, I see it. It just feeds, instead of engaging in with actual issues at hand, it just blames some immigrant. It blames some minority in America. Cause that's like a tale as old as time.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. And it's like, and by the way, the food system would grind to a screeching halt if we were to eliminate immigrants from our food system, right? I mean, who would pick the food? Who would process the food? Who would slaughter the animals? Who would cut them up and pack them? I mean, these are all done by immigrants, usually undocumented.
I just want to add, just to such a good point, because I forgot to add this, just to add to my answer about NAFTA. The dark secret is all my barons present themselves as farmers in popular media and in news, but they're really just capital asset managers. The real farmers are the undocumented people doing the actual work. And there's a whole dark undercurrent too, where most of them were farmers back home in Central America before we dumped our surplus corn on them, causing a massive migration crisis. Like the whole thing is like, there's this level of cosplay among my barons I find really funny.
Well, it would be funnier if it were not so tragic. But I mean, honestly, decisions like that, which we as Americans pay very little attention to, and we want to hear the stuff that makes us feel the best about our systems, whatever they are. And that's certainly one of our favorite tropes, is that, we're feeding the world. That's a big trope that the food industry likes to brew it about, especially the meat industry. Oh, well, without our proteins, I mean, people would starve to death. Absolute nonsense. But that stuff, everybody buys that because that's the prevailing narrative. But the reality is that, our decision in NAFTA have had this massive impact on South and Central America and Mexico. So that's what you want to talk about, why we have this huge influx of immigrants? Right there is the reason. Yep. Because we took away these people's ability to take care of themselves. So where are they going to come? They're going to come to the United States to get these jobs. They got to have some money. They got to support their families. They can no longer farm profitably because we have dumped, as you just said, all of our corn onto their market, or all of our whatever it is we want to sell. We'll sell it there, and that will take away their industry because we could sell it for less than they can.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Republicans rail about freaking immigration. I mean,
it's just, the irony. I mean, my dairy baron's really good at that.
Yeah. Right. Meanwhile, who milks those cows? Yeah, you guessed it, people. It is amazing. Anyway, let's talk about your prescription, doctor.
Yeah, so like my few key takeaways. First of all, nothing bothers me more than reading a book that critiques everything and doesn't offer concrete solutions. So that was a big priority item for me. One, put animals back on the land. I think it's the best thing you can do for rural America. It's, phase out these industrial animal facilities and go back to the way we always used to farm animals. I'm at the second thing I would do, and we should just junk or sunset the farm bill as we know it. I'm talking the farm entitlement programs. Take those three programs, put them in the one pot of money for conservation programs, and do that with it. It's just crop insurance, the commodity support programs. They're just too rotten. They're too broken.
Yeah. Right. And they're just business as usual. They continue to support industries that are extractive and that are ruining our environment.
Yeah. And then even the conservation program itself is pretty corrupted at this point, where you can get conservation money if you build a hog manure lagoon,
So I know it's a great sadness to me, Austin, because I serve on the board of my local conservation district, and we work a lot with Natural Resources Conservation Services, an arm of the USDA. And, you know, they're all in on, you know, the climate smart practices, which I've also done a lot of programming around, you know, and which is essentially a giveaway to these large industries again, you know what I mean? But the NRCS is going all in on that, and they're not really going all in on, you know, actually helping people understand important conservation techniques, which are developing it.
Yeah, I mean, that's why, well, speaking of like personnel stuff, I really encourage your listeners and you know, people working at nonprofits is we got to change who's in these positions of power.
Yeah.
There's a government book called Purple Book. It lists all the political appointees. USDA is full of them. I mean, we can have, you know, hacks for industry, or you can get farmers doing the right thing or people doing the right thing in these positions of power, and no one's going to get a seat at the table. You have to fight for it. Like that, mm-hmm. That's a big thing of mine. Because imagine if you had someone allocating that money who actually understood it and like wasn't just, you know, had a sustainable framework. But I would also say my last two things are, one, speaking of USDA, I'm also kind of in favor of stripping it for parts, or at least threatening to. Nothing scares industry more in DC than when you attack or threaten its budget, because, like, for example, there's no reason why USDA has a carve out for meat antitrust authority. Give that to the Federal Trade Commission. It's so clearly incapable of, you know, protecting that industry. And my last thing, and this is something your listeners can do locally, is help your farmers at the farmers market get local procurement contracts. I mean, that's such a make or break thing for these farmers.
Sure.
It's such a stabilizing mechanism for them too. And who doesn't want good local food at their local school?
Right. Absolutely. Schools, universities, hospitals, hotels. I mean, these are the people who should be buying locally as much as they can. So anyway, we got to leave it there. Austin, thank you so much. Again, Austin's book is called Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. It comes out from Island Press in just a couple of days. You can order it now from your local bookstore or from the dreaded Amazon. Austin, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed the book. It's a quick read. Austin is a wonderfully engaging writer. I really learned a lot. And that's saying something, because like I said, I've been doing this a long time. I even wrote my own book about the meat industry. So, but I learned quite a bit from your book, and I really appreciate your efforts there. So thank you.
Some words. And for having me on, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, come back. We'll have more to talk about, I'm sure, as your work progresses. So stay tuned. Thank you, Austin. And thanks to our sponsors for supporting this radio station. And thanks to my listeners, as always, for tuning into this show. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye for now.
What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights, is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.